Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Atsuko Kirk, who is a documentary filmmaker based in New York. And actually, Atsuko and I went to the same middle school in Japan and even played basketball together every day for 2 years. And I happened to find her by hearing about her great documentary film about Japanese school lunch, which we'll discuss today. Also, Atsuko is an environmental advocate, and she just released a very inspiring new film about ocean and plastic. So we'll discuss it too. But quickly, before we start, Japanese is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as podcasts. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher and subscribe to Japanese, and please write a review on iTunes or Stitcher. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Now, let's start our conversation with Akiko Kirk. Hello, Atsuko. Atsuko Kirk. Hello, Atsuko. Welcome to Japanese.
Hello. Yes. Long time no see. It's amazing that you and I just, you know, sitting here.
It's an amazing that you haven't changed even a bit.
Oh, thank you.
I'm serious. So, okay. So, for listeners who doesn't know you too much, so first of all, tell us about your background. So, where are you from and where, when and why did you come to New York?
Hi, my name is Atsuko Kwak, and I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I used to be doing more on production side of filmmaking, which, you know, I worked on like TV shows, commercials, but more on producing, not like really the filmmaking, the creative side of it. And I came to New York City when I was 27, which is 20-something years ago, and
I was like, sounds like yesterday.
Right? I know. But I was in Tokyo working as an ad executive for ad agency in Tokyo. But it was so right after the bubble economy, and it was really depressing to be there. And then I was like, I have to get out of here. Mm-hmm. So then I came to New York. I have come to New York like maybe 3 times back then, and then I loved it and the energy, and then maybe, you know, I can do something new, and then I can do more filmmaking. And then so I started those like production work for I was doing for like 15 years. And then but after that, one day I went to my son's, public school. That's elementary school when my son was like maybe first grade or kindergarten. And then I saw the cafeteria, and then that was the beginning of this whole another journey that I took for the environment and then food, healthy eating, and all that.
Okay, so let's jump onto that film. So so you made this 9-minute documentary film, which is, seems to be more than 9 minutes, like an hour intense version of it. So it's called The School Lunch in Japan. It's not just about eating, which came out in 2010. So, and you have over 15 million views on this film on YouTube.
Right.
Which is amazing.
Right. I mean, you know, just the YouTube views are 15 million right now, but that has been shared with other, one of those Facebook like a product, like a promoting sites, and then they have like 45 million views just for that. So anyway, so the really the first intention of, to make this little video was that I just simply wanted to show how Japanese lunch operates to school food directors in New York City. So back then, it was probably 2008, 2009, I started going to my son's cafeteria to volunteer, and just because if you never seen school cafeterias in public schools, it was a mess. Just walked in, the like, how many chicken nuggets are on the floor? And the bins overflowing, and like a milk on the floor just leaking, and then nobody, nobody bothered to pick it up or clean up or anything. And I was just shocked.
Sounds like after the big parade on the Fifth Avenue.
Exactly. it was exactly like that.
Wow.
The way kids eat and disposing the whole tray, like throw it into the bin and then, drop something and nobody cares. And then, even more shocking was that the kids actually left the room without cleaning up.
That's scary, but it's just, they think it's okay.
Well, and I thought, maybe it was a special day that they didn't need to clean up or something. And then I asked a staff member right there who is taking care of the lunch period. And then, she couldn't really, understand what I'm talking about. It was like, what? And, do they need to clean the floor or anything? And then she said, no. Kids are not supposed to clean the floor. That's custodian's job.
Interesting.
That was exactly the welcome to America moment. So then, and this is a school, right? So I just couldn't understand how that is allowed, in any countries.
Right.
And then I just went right to the principal, and I just, we gotta do something. And then that was like 2007, 2008. And then principal, of course, she wanted to do something. She, wasn't happy about the situation. But, all the excuses that, staff is busy, we don't have extra hands, who is going to, So, but what about the kids? We have hundreds of hands here.
Right.
So, and then, oh, they don't have enough time to eat. It was true. They only had 25 minutes walk in and walk out. And they had to be on the line for the lunch, right? By the time some kids sit down and started eating, they only have like as short as 7 minutes to eat.
Wow.
So that's a completely another component of the problem that they were facing. And then hundreds of kids with just three staff members. Teachers are not eating together, of course. So that kids are like all over the place. And,
Right.
So there are other components. But at least the last few minutes, they can do something.
Mm.
So I started going there and started doing by myself mm-hmm. before we ask kids to do,
mm-hmm.
to show, you know, what would be possible to do.
Mm.
Then after a while, you know, one child I still remember, and we're still in touch, that Ethan, he was second grade back then, and he stood up and, can I help you?
Oh.
It was really organically happened that way. And I was like, yes. So, and now he started, you know, helping out and then sorting, you know, the trash and then recycling and then, and then he was so proud, and this is my job. And then other kids are like, how come he gets to do that? Can I do that?
Wow.
Can I help you? And it's like really happened that way.
Mm.
And the transformation started. But also we needed a transformation for adults.
Mm.
Now, the school food directors, they are not in charge of anything, you know, the recycling or anything for the kids, because there, you know, there are some job lines of,
right.
You know.
The adults who are in charge of and the
right,
paid
so
for
that,
it.
So. Yeah, right. So now, but still, I wanted everybody to be on board. And that was the tough thing, because the school food directors and then kitchen workers, they are hired by the school food division. And then the custodians are hired by a different division. And then the school aides and staff who take care of the kids in the lunchroom, they are hired by principal.
Mm.
So that those three different stream of employment, actually they don't talk to each other. They don't really cooperate each other.
Right.
So that was, you know, one of the hundreds of, you know, components. And then to bring all of them together, I just wanted to simply show the, you know, how Japanese school lunch operates.
Mm.
So, and the school food director, actually the director of school food, he's still there now, Mr. Stephen O'Brien. I asked him, he's the top person of DOE, you know, oversee the whole school.
So New York City Department of Education.
Right. And I want to actually go to Japan and film the school lunch operation in Japan. And I just need some kind of letter that this is from New York City Department of Education, that they want to learn something from Japan so that the Japanese schools and then Department of Education know that I am coming in educational purpose. Mm. I'm not a stranger just asking get into the school. So that he said yes.
But it's amazing that you convinced him to write such a letter.
Right. So I got the letter, like, yeah. And then I went.
But did you explain to him?
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course.
Like,
no, he
details.
Was all for it. They work hard. But they have limited budget, you know, like they, because the magnitude of this whole big operation is they serve close to 1 million meals per day just for New York City public schools.
Right.
It is the second biggest institutional food operation after military. So the biggest food operation, actually. And then the after New York City, the second one is Los Angeles, but less than half of New York City.
Mm.
So it is a huge, huge operation that he really needs to oversee everything.
Mm.
So, but, you know, he really wanted to change. And back then, it was still, like, really hard and, like, you know, that wouldn't happen. You know, some people weren't really cooperative.
Right. So, and you know, the beginning of the film, you know, that when you talk about improving school lunch, all the comments are on the quality of the food itself. And let's start the conversation on the quality of the lunchtime. So let's talk about the theme of the film. So what do you mean by that?
It means that especially back then there were a lot of attention to bad school lunch in U.S.
Mm.
You know, Jamie Oliver, you know, all that attention went into the quality of the food.
Right.
You know, it's a junk food. Like, it wasn't, they were trying.
Right.
You know,
it's more that obesity issue.
Obesity issues and everything. But nobody was talking about the quality of the that meal, like lunchtime experience itself.
Right. Well, let me ask you though. So I'm going to break down a couple of things because it's very distinctively different. So the first of all, I noticed that teachers eat lunch with kids. So what kind of difference does it make for students, you think?
Right. I mean, teachers eat with students in Japan, but not in the U.S.
Mm.
Most of the schools. Which means the in Japan, the lunch periods are placed as an educational period.
Mm.
It is the same as math, science. It is the, you know, the educational time so that there are learning happening through the lunchtime experience.
Right.
But in U.S., the lunch period is just to fill up your stomach.
Right, and so that's break.
Right, it's a break. Exactly. Mm. So the complete difference that the base is completely different. So that really is making a cultural difference in the lunchtime.
Mm.
And then also what I noticed after I started going to the cafeteria is that most of the kids didn't thank to the lunch ladies when they get the food. So, like, kids are not saying thank you. Oh, my God. I noticed that, and that bothered me. Mm. Probably, you know, being Japanese, that's, like, the part that really bothered me.
Right.
And then I counted one day at how many kids will thank the lunch ladies, and it was 5 kids out of 95
wow.
students. And I thought maybe that really is, you know, like that is the root of the whole change that needs to happen.
Mm. So I think in Japanese schools, I think lunch ladies are like kind of substitute to your mother versus here, they're workers. So that's the mindset, completely different.
Right. I mean, in Japan, also, they difference of that caring spirit that really holds through the school,
right.
not only the lunchtime, so that the cultural difference is playing a big role. Still, the system to place lunch period as the educational period is the biggest difference, I think.
Right.
And then also the, you know, appreciation and, you know, that whole cultural thing.
Right. That's interesting because I was thinking, how many times do we say thank you in Japanese, in Japan? If you live in Japan, it's like at least 10 times a day, right? To something.
Right.
So, like, itadakimasu and thank you before you eat.
Right.
After too. Right. So, the other thing is that the participation of students to prepare lunch at, you know, each school lunch program.
Right. So that, that's a part of it, that the whole operation that in Japan, students feel ownership of the operation.
Mm.
I mean, probably you used to be one of those that, you know, you have a lunch duty.
Mm-hmm. So can you describe how it works? When, you know,
right, school lunches in Japan, students will actually go to the kitchen and then take their food, coming back to the classrooms. Most of the Japanese schools eat lunches in their classrooms with their teachers. So that the lunch duty people, maybe like 5 or 6 of them in the class,
they take turns.
But they if like you are a lunch duty, you get a lunch duty for a week, and then go to the kitchen, get the whole like a you know, bucket full of soup or, mm-hmm. you know, those sometimes really heavy. But they carried over, you know, back to their classroom, mm. and then they serve to peers, their peers. Right. That part really makes students feel like they own this whole operation.
Hey, yeah, I'm smiling because I have such a fond memory about that, you know, like...
Right, I used to, you know, like really look forward to be lunch duty. You know? So that was really a fun part of it.
Mm, right. And then, and also the kids, you know, they convert this whole classroom into like a dining, restaurant dining situation.
Right, right. Some, I mean, it's by classes and schools, but mainly it's fun socializing time.
Right.
So that they sort of change the arrangements of the tables and chairs, desks mm-hmm. and chairs,
right. and create a little tables of islands of groups of kids.
Right, a lot of the schools do that. Mm. Some schools that I went, they actually make the whole big table for the whole class, so that everybody can see each other.
Ah, that's kinda cute.
Yeah. So
right, so it's a lot more social setting.
Right, right, right.
Because I think I remember that, you know, I was not eating with the same friends all the time. It was assigned by, you know, kind of the teacher and the program. So you can kind of change a rotating group of friends eating together as
right,
well.
Right, right, right. Yeah. And some schools in Japan right now, they have actual lunchroom called, you know, it's like a cafeteria thing. For more special occasions, like special meals for festivals and stuff that they use.
Right.
Or collaborative lunchtime, like different grades eat together, or they invite parents, or, you know, those things. But basically, the usual lunchtime happens in classrooms.
Mm. So do you think it's kind of a training of social dining as well?
Right, and also get to know about food and ingredients and then all the other nutritional education component is collaborated into, you know, included into this whole lunch period experience.
Mm. Oh, speaking of, so I heard there is a system of the nutrition teacher. What is that?
It is a nutritional teacher. That used to be like a kitchen lady, but now they made the title different, and then now they need more trainings and then a college degree and stuff to be a nutritional teacher.
Mm.
So that the nutritional teachers are in charge of ordering food, making menus, and then also that educational component of the about nutrition and also local farming and all that.
Oh, wow. So they come in at lunchtime and tell them?
Right, a lot of them go around the classrooms and then do some lecture, or they actually do other cooking classes or some other programs besides just for lunch.
Mm, right. And what first my radio experience was when I was at elementary school, there's a lunchtime radio, and you read all those the nutritional values
right.
of each lunch.
That's right. All the schools that I went, I visited like numerous schools in Japan for lunchtime, and all of them were doing that.
Mm.
Actually, the nutritional teachers provide the all the information around today's menu, where the carrots are coming from, where, you know, and then what kind of a nutritional value that the each ingredient has, that so that's provided to each class. The classroom leaders for the day will read it, you know, like read out loud to the class that today, carrots are coming from Mr. Saito's farm
wow.
in this area. And right, and then that has a lot of vitamin A that that it's good for your eyes, you know, things like that. So that's before itadakimasu. That's, you know, before they eat.
Mm. Wow. I wish I could sit there too.
All right, right.
To be reminded. Right. And so the other interesting thing I found in the film is that, you know, the serving, you know, kids serving the lunch counts leftovers and report to the whole class, you know, before they start eating. So why they do that?
To not all the classes or schools do that, but basically they don't want to have any leftovers.
Mm.
Any food, you know, came into the classroom should be consumed.
Mm.
So that's the whole, also the cultural part of it, that they don't want to leave any food behind.
Mm.
So that the kids will be already prepared to think, maybe I'll get the seconds for the soup today. Or so... that's
so like rock, paper, scissors, and then you fight for the leftover.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a big battle.
Right. I remember I still did that too.
Right, right, right.
Right. So, and so the after lunch, that's another big thing I found in the films. Every day, kids clean literally the whole school for 20 minutes, including their classroom, whole even teacher's room. So, is this a cultural too, you think?
Yes, that's very, very much so.
Mm.
That especially all the comments for YouTube, that cleaning part is as well as really impressed that people, you know, around the world actually, that do they do every day? I can't believe, or you know, like so that. Is a big part of it.
Mm.
Also, that to have the ownership of also the place that where you eat, where you you know, study, you know, and also to have a, you know, pride of that they actually take, you know, taking care of the place.
Right, and the kids are looking really happy to clean up.
Right, right. Right. Yeah,
it's like a social and fun activity.
Right, right.
And the proud of being able to clean up so much, so well.
Right.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, so to summarize, what's the benefit of having that kind of a school lunch and cleanup program?
I think the whole ownership of the lunchtime experience, because it is every single day, it really makes a difference on the attitude of, not attitude of eating, but attitude of the lunchtime or mealtime. So what the eating means, you know, mealtime includes all those elements so that for Japanese kids, that comes as a package. You know, eating something means you appreciate the food, you clean up after yourself, you know, it's all like a set deal.
It's almost lifestyle education.
Right, right, right. So that lifetime skills too. So that's really the difference that U.S. actually doesn't have. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about how Atsuko has replicated Japanese lunch programs in New York City. So please stay with us.
Hey, it's Kathy Irway, the host of Eat Your Words. Today I'm here with Camilla Salisbury, author of Bob's Red Mill Everyday Gluten-Free Cookbook, 281 Delicious Whole Grain Recipes. We're going to get to the bottom of this gluten-free craze. So why aren't people eating gluten, and what does gluten-free really mean?
Well, there are two main reasons why people are deciding to go gluten-free these days. And the first one is really serious. It's for people who have celiac disease, and it's a pretty serious condition. But then there is also a growing number of people with gluten intolerance or gluten sensitivity, and they're trying out gluten-free diets because they find that eating foods without gluten just makes them feel better.
Okay, got it. But what actually makes something gluten-free?
Well, what makes something gluten-free is essentially that it doesn't have any of the protein, gluten, in it. And a lot of people are surprised to learn that many grains do not contain gluten, when in fact just a very small number of grains do.
Does anyone offer truly gluten-free options?
Well, Bob's Red Mill really understands gluten-free options, and that means they separate their grains during the manufacturing process, and so they're testing each batch at every step of the way for purity to ensure that it's gluten-free. So when it says on the package that it's gluten-free, you can be assured that it is gluten-free.
All right, so gluten-free listeners out there craving some steel-cut oats can pick up a pack of Bob's Red Mill and rest assured you're getting the real deal. Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and all the gluten-free products that they offer at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
So welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Atsuko Kirk, who is a documentary filmmaker and environmental advocate based in New York. And before we restart our conversation, I would like to say one thing. As you may know, this show is only possible thanks to member donations. We'd literally not be able to reach you every week without the generosity of Heritage Radio Network members around the world. So becoming a member is very easy. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate right now. So thank you so much. Now, so you not only made the inspiring film, but you also took action to bring the Japanese school lunch program to the U.S. And the project is called the Cafeteria Culture. So what is cafeteria culture and what is the objective of the program?
Yeah, so Cafeteria Culture is a nonprofit organization based in New York City, and which I work for. And since I started as a volunteer in my son's school to sort of organize this whole student operation, lunchtime, recycling and sorting, and cleanup, then I met the director of the Cafeteria Culture back then, and then she was working towards get rid of the styrofoam trays that has been, you know, used for New York City for that last like 30 years, and that's because toxic and then it hurts environment. So then we sort of got together and started to do this, you know, student operation actually more systematic that could be replicated by other schools.
Mm.
Now that I started with my son's school, that, you know, I made exactly the same, the Japanese operation, that, you know, they rotate the like a shift, that there are five kids in charge of one lunch period, and then there's a recycling captain, there's a trash captain, there's a table captain, and they're excited, they have the tags, and then so then the next, you know, the next week will be the different kids come in as a recycling captain, and you know, all that, and then within a month the same school takes care of the whole lunch operation, and then the next month another class will be in charge of the cafeteria operation, which we call it Cafeteria Rangers.
Mm, that's a great name, by
the way. Cafeteria Rangers. So that they so they loved it. Now that so we made more videos and instructional tools online to be available for other schools that can, you know, do the same thing.
Mm.
Even the my son's school, in the same building, there were close to 1,000 students eating lunch, and there used to be 30 to 35 big garbage bags a day just from lunch. And after the Cafeteria Rangers, they reduced into 5 or 6 bags a day.
Amazing.
Right. It was a big change. And of course, we needed the cooperation from custodians, and you know, but they were happy. They don't need to haul like a heavy 30 bags.
Right.
Now they have 5 bags. And then, of course, they have more recycling and stuff, but overall far less bags and far less landfill bound garbage.
Right. And the recycling education.
Right.
No extra cost.
Exactly.
Kids work.
Exactly.
As the rangers.
Right, exactly.
Mm. Wow,
so,
that's amazing.
And the cafeteria culture, we get funded by like a government and then some other private foundations to do not only the cafeteria rangers, but also the educational component in classrooms for why it is important to sort your, waste, and then also recycling, and then also reducing plastic use and all that. So now when we started going into classrooms, we found out that when we explain the journey of the whole trash starting from the classroom, that so the garbage can there, who is gonna actually take that bag? And then the custodian takes it, and where that goes next. So going back to the curbside, who is going to take the garbage bags? And the truck comes in, where the truck goes.
Mm.
That part, that truck goes to a, it's called a waste transfer stations. That's in a really underserved area like South Bronx and then North Brooklyn. They were taking like 70 something percent of the New York City garbage into transfer stations. So because of the thousands of trucks coming every day, their high rate of asthma, and so it's more the picture of environmental justice and other part that you never thought about.
Right.
So once you go into that, then really students grasp the consequences of the trash.
Right.
And not only, if we say, the Atsuko will talk about recycling, and then, kids will like, But if we take that to the next level of talking about how kids like you in South Bronx suffering from asthma because of our garbage going in there.
Mm.
So that really changed the complete motivation to do sorting well, the cafeteria rangers. That's completely another level. Mm.
Because they know that they can do something to change
that. Right, right. Yeah, so, and then from the cafeteria ranger program, we found out there are a couple of aha moments for the students that when, if we don't sort well or you litter on the street, that goes into the sewer when it rains and then go into the sewer pipe, go out to the river and go out to the ocean and killing turtles or fish. Or so that part, the students really like, aha moments and sort of get the whole picture of our consumption. So, amazing. And behavior.
Right. Well, I was so impressed to watch all those videos about, the capturing cafeteria rangers, and it's really strong, very strong messages. So I'm going to put that link to all those videos.
Great.
And it's a nice change with the subject because I wanted to talk about your new documentary. It's called Kids in Tokyo and New York City Share a Message About Marine Litter. So what's the theme of the film?
Right, so that derived from the Cafeteria Ranger program that we started teaching about the plastic litter going into the ocean and impacts marine life. So that became a big part of it. Also, I actually made a movie about the litter and marine pollution back in 2014. And that sort of like the whole global problem that, but it is global problem, but it's hyper-local problem too.
Mm.
So that litter you drop right in the neighborhood is becoming the global problem because the ocean it really is, you know, one ocean that we have,
right?
One water we have. So now that not only New York City, but kids in Tokyo, you know, I wanted them to feel the magnitude of this global problem. They both are working in locally, but I want them to really realize this is not only us, but other part of the world is having the same issue. So, and then when kids realize, then if we show in the movie, then people will realize.
Right.
So that's the whole point of the film.
Right. It's really cute that in the movie, one of the kids from Japan said, leaders on beach and rivers really look the same in Tokyo and New York. I felt that we both have the same problem. We want to make the difference together. And the New York City kids, we can do it together. So that's really strong.
Right. And those plastic litter, it looks exactly the same everywhere. Everywhere you go.
Right.
It looks like exactly the same, unfortunately.
Right.
On beaches, on rivers, in ocean, everywhere.
Right. So the global economy really reflects in negatively as well.
Right.
So, and by the same token, because we are connected, we can be connected easily by the internet, because you connected two classrooms, New York City and Tokyo.
Right.
And it's a really strong visually. They see each other.
Right.
And it's just it's possible now.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that they, you know, fortunately the technology gave us opportunities, you know, for those things to happen.
Right. So I wanted to ask you that, you know, what's the scope of the Cafeteria Rangers? Is it only in New York City right now?
Cafeteria Ranger program is actually, we have the whole how-to videos and tools online on cafeteriaculture.org. If you go there, it's called Soar to Save. Soar to Save. You know, your school anywhere in the U.S. or maybe other parts of the world can use whole or part of it. And you want to modify, you know, suitable to your school, but base idea is there so that you can use that rotational student monitoring program in your school to really do sort well, and how to sort of bring in custodians and school food staff. And so you know, universally being used.
What is considering you have 60 million viewers of the film, so I'm sure people contacted you to apply.
Right. And in some schools in New York City, we still go to schools to actually advise Cafeteria Ranger programs too. But basically, our idea is to make videos and tools that schools can run on their own.
Okay. And so what's your next project?
Next project will be we continue to that plastic pollution avenue. That's we will probably be making a movie, another movie about that. And also we're going to, this year, because we were so focused on this plastic pollution problem, so we weren't in school cafeterias as much as we wanted to be. So, but this school year, I mean next school year from September, we'll go back to the cafeteria and we'll do a little more food waste and then a little more extensive cafeteria programs.
Well, I really highly recommend every school kids watch the film with the teachers and the parents.
Right.
Okay, so please do keep me posted.
Yes.
And then hopefully we can come back here.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great.
Okay, so thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So nice to
see you again.
I'll put all the links to your films on the show page for this episode 90.
Great. Thank you.
And listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradio.org or kikokatema.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradio.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcast. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. Really appreciate your feedback. And our engineer today is Peter Harsh. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.